week's ride from here, such as keeping four court sorcerers busy while they do something unrelated,
Morella suggested. An excellent point, Sethridge conceded, frowning. Well, since you have decided not to be useful in investigating the weapon, you can go try to discover whatever this other scheme might be. His tone was bitter enough to border on outright hostility. Lydia frowned as well, but she wasn't mirroring Sethridge intentionally this time. She found that the possibilities were growing ever more disturbing.
I don't need your permission to be here or to leave, Morella pointed out in a neutral tone, leaning forward slightly as she spoke. But I do have better things to do.
She stood, nodding at Verudin and Lydia, and departed from the chamber. That was a bit cold, Verudin pointed out after the woman had closed the door behind her. I believe she may be involved, Sethridge explained, drawing a shocked glance from Verudin. Lydia managed to keep her own expression neutral. A spark triggered by defensive sorcery is not a sufficient reason for her to avoid casting a non-invasive spell on the weapon to identify its properties. She is an expert. If nothing else, she could simply wear a pair of gloves.
That does not necessarily mean she's hiding any sort of involvement, Lydia pointed out. She could, for example, be going to go inspect the weapon right now, while the three of us are in here debating, and then keep the knowledge to herself.
Verudin turned his shocked look toward Lydia. Am I the only one here who believes in honesty and trust? Yes, Sethridge said without hesitation.
Pretty much, Lydia conceded, nodding. Though to be clear, I was not stating that I thought what she was doing was inappropriate. She may have a good reason for wanting to gather information and keep it to herself.
Oh? Such as? Sethridge asked.
If she suspects the weapon is real, and finds confirmation that it is, she may want to gather enough information to try to figure out how the Dominion marks on the weapon work. According to legend, the Sakes has at least 7 Dominion marks on the blade. Dominion marks are impossible to replicate in modern sorcery. Knowing how to replicate that technique would be incredibly valuable information, especially if only she had it,
Lydia asked. What she hadn't said, but that the others almost certainly knew, say perhaps Verudin, was that Dominion marks were only found on the ancient objects imbued with powerful sorcery, colloquially called artifacts. Artifacts were thought to have been forged by the gods themselves in the earliest days of the world, and many sorcerers actively hunted for artifacts for prestige, or in hopes of learning to weave the sorcery used to create them. And what is to stop you or Istvan from learning the same details after she does? Sethridge inquired, sounding genuinely intrigued by this line of discussion.
Well, she could replace the weapon with a copy. Tricky, given the limited time. More likely, she simply expects that Istvan and I are not as good at analyzing sorceress characteristics of objects as she is. She would most likely be correct if she made that assumption. But this is pure speculation, and it remains more likely that she is both unconnected to this whole incident and that she is not going to go inspect it right now. I was simply giving an example of an alternate motive behind why she may not have wanted to look at it earlier.
Sethridge nodded. Your point has been made. Well, regardless, it is best if you take a look at the weapon soon, in case Morella is trying to do something to keep the secrets to herself. Also, we should take turns speaking to the prisoner.
I already have, actually. He seems nice, Verudin said.
Seeing stares the other two sorcerers gave him in response, Verudin continued.
What? I wanted to get a good image of him in my head in case he escapes later. Too often we waste time on discussion, not acting until it's too late. He may have escaped by now for all we know.
I doubt that, Sethridge said. They did put him in the Adelin room, after all. The Adelin room was named after Prince Adelin, a legendary prince who had been captured in battle when Orlan was still part of the Zixian Empire. The Zixians had promised during a parley with Adelin's father to keep him in a chamber filled with all the amenities entitled to a prince, while the other kingdom bargained for Adelin's release. Adelin had died, chained to the wall of a pretty room, just out of reach of his precious amenities. The Zixians had held true to the word of their bargain, just as they had always been famous for. A lesser-known quality of the Adelan Room was that it was located near the palace's barracks, allowing the palace's guards to keep watch on the room with minimal effort.
"The proximity to the barracks means anyone visiting the prisoner will likely be noticed. Captain Randall probably carries the key, which means several people could find out if I go ask for it. That's less than ideal."
Viruddin raised a hand and rubbed his forehead. "Who ordered him to be put in the Adelan Room anyway? That seems a little harsh." Sethridge turned to Viruddin, offering him an exhausted shrug. "Captain Randall, I assume his orders came down from the prince."
"A prince ordering someone to be held in the Adelan Room? That's rather ironic."
"Well," Lydia said,
"I suppose I'd better go take a look at that sword."
"If you find anything of interest, please let us know," Viruddin implored her.
"Of course," Lydia replied.
She planned to do nothing of the kind. Lydia took hasty steps as she headed to the palace's armory. Her heart wanted to run, and her mind quickly outpaced even that.
"Is this man an agent of the gods? If so, will my involvement interfere with their plans? No, more likely he is some sort of spy, but if so, from who? Would Veldhrin be foolish enough to be so overt? What could they possibly gain?"
Her mind sorted through other options as she walked, trying to maintain some measure of composure.
"Either Morella is right and he's a distraction, or he's an agent of a third party. The Kessites, maybe? Or the Rethri? The Kessites have the best incentive. A war between Orlan and Veldhrin could leave both cities vulnerable to conquest."
She noticed her arrival at the armory door as her hand moved to lift key to lock.
"I need to focus,"
she told herself, turning the key. Inside were assorted weapons, pieces of armor, and seemingly random trinkets. Her eyes caught the unmistakable hilt of the sole object that resembled a legendary sword. Her heart still racing, Lydia hesitated, not out of fear, but out of reverence.
"Gods, if by your grace you have chosen to guide me to this weapon, please give me the wisdom to know how to deal with it."
With that prayer in mind and a grim expression, Lydia stepped inside and shut the door. While she knew intellectually that prayers had never been proven to elicit direct results, and she doubted the gods had any method for hearing the errant thoughts of their followers, prayer had been drilled into her at such a young age that she engaged in it unconsciously as a matter of habit. She did not bother to lock the door to the room. It would delay any potential rescuers if she injured herself by triggering a more powerful defensive spell than Viruddin had. Her eyes scanned from side to side. Lydia noted no one else to observe her actions, but that did not mean no one was watching. She desperately wanted to speak aloud, to declare her allegiance to the weapon. Her faith was one reason, but practicality was the greater of the two. The spells on the blade might allow a true believer in the Taos Pantheon to draw it from the scabbard. With the utmost hesitation, Lydia grasped the leather grip of the weapon with her right and the scabbard with her left. Silently, she pulled on the hilt, attempting to separate the two. The scabbard remained firmly in place. Some childish fragment of hope in Lydia's mind was shattered, but her natural inclination toward problem-solving filled the gap. A scabbard stuck in place did not imply the gods did not want her to have the weapon. It simply meant that there was some force keeping the sword in place, a force she had not yet identified. She had a spell for that.
"Dominion of knowledge, I invoke you," Lydia said aloud, knowing that unlike a declaration of faith, this would not arouse any suspicion if overheard.
Her vision momentarily blackened as the spell took hold. Letters flashed in her mind's vision, showing her fragments of a broken thought.
Eru ndi laris cor son taris di ni et es o an.
Every knowledge sorcerer experienced using the Dominion Analysis spell slightly differently from what Lydia had been told. Some saw images, like memories stolen from other eyes. Others said they heard a voice whispering the answers they sought. Still others claimed that after casting the spell, they simply knew the answer, as if they always had. Lydia found herself sitting on the stone floor with no memory of how she had gotten there. The sword lay across her lap, still contained in its scabbard. Lydia narrowed her eyes at the weapon. Knowledge sorcery would extract a fragment of her own knowledge as a cost each time she used it, but she had never experienced a blackout from casting it. Any memories the spells had stolen in her past had been subtle. Lydia's spell had always presented her with text. That was no surprise. Books and scrolls were her greatest friends and the only loyal ones. She had never before been betrayed with mere fragments of an answer. Her legs felt weak, but she managed to wobble to her feet.
What in the resh was that? More defensive sorcery, like what Varudin mentioned?
She did not dismiss that possibility entirely, but she shoved it aside in favor of other options.
Perhaps the spell failed, or I cast it improperly, or,
she considered with some hesitation,
perhaps the weapon is so powerful, I can't even understand what I just experienced.
The last option she considered only for the sake of completeness. Assuming the weapon's dominion marks were beyond her comprehension would be unproductive.
More likely, she continued to consider, I came in contact with multiple dominions at once. The spell is made to identify a single dominion. If the sword carries several dominion marks, as in legends, perhaps my spell was simply unable to translate that information. I may need to develop a new spell to try to analyze this further.
Lydia nodded, finding that explanation acceptable for the moment, and returned to her focus on a completely different series of problems. The sorceress returned the weapon to its position on the table with some reluctance, and then used the table to support her weight. She was still feeling dizzy, which was not a good sign. Focusing as best she could, Lydia examined the weapon. At a glance, the weapon fit the description she had always heard. A hilt long enough for two hands to fit comfortably, a long and elegant blade, and a metal that shined with greater luster than any silver she had ever before witnessed. She carefully lifted the sword a few inches, trying to peer inside the scabbard to see if she could get a look at the runes that should have been visible on the surface, but the sheath was flush against the blade. The scabbard itself was an oddity. It was wrapped in white leather, a color used to demonstrate affluence, but with metal plating along the sides and covering the entire tip. It struck a beautiful image, but so much metal on a scabbard had to be impractical. Not that the god of swords would have been inconvenienced much by such a thing, she mused, but he was supposed to be a pragmatic deity.
"That's the first thing I've noted that's out of place," she considered, "and, now that I think about it, the scabbard isn't in Aendarin's colors. He wears silver, black, and blue. This is white and iron, I suppose."
It was not much evidence of the sword being a fake, but little else provided her with a clue. Lifting the weapon again, she moved into a combat stance. Raising the weapon into position felt easy, fluid, even with the scabbard on the weapon. The weight of the sword was negligible. She could feel it, but the weight only seemed to be enough to remind her that the weapon was in her hand. The blade felt heavier from the presence of the scabbard, but only slightly.
"I could take it," Lydia considered. "I could do more experiments in my room, or just flee the city with it entirely. If this really is the Sekhes, it could change everything in Veldhrin in an instant. If I could learn how the marks work, it could usher in a new era for sorcery. And even if I failed to do that, the mere presence of the sword could save numerous lives. If stories of the weapon's power are true, a proper wielder could turn aside entire armies."
She dismissed the idea almost as quickly as it came to her. She could get permission to take the sword to her chambers later. Just walking off with it now would be a needless complication. Attempting to get back to Veldhrin with the sword would be considerably more difficult. The weapon's absence would be noticed within hours. With Mirella's detection spells and Varudin's teleportation, it was likely they could catch up to her. More importantly, Returning to Velthrin now would require abandoning her mission. Her responsibility was to gather information on the most prominent local sorcerers, as well as the supposed gods of the city. She delivered her reports during the infrequent opportunities her position gave her the excuse to travel to Velthrin's territory, and she had no such excuse right now. Her mission had no set end date. She would be dismissed when her superiors felt she had done sufficient work, or if her cover had been significantly jeopardized. The Sekes was most likely worth abandoning her mission, but the prisoner who had carried it was potentially even more important.
I need answers, conclusive answers, and for that, I need to meet with the prisoner directly.
Lydia returned to her chamber, making preparations and strategizing for contingencies, and then, after preparing an extra set of robes and putting a mask matching that of another sorcerer in her pouch, Lydia initiated the first stage of her plan. Since Lydia lived in the palace, passing by the Adelan room a few times throughout the day, hours apart, didn't attract any undue attention. Each time, she ensured she had an unrelated agenda nearby, just in case she was asked. It was on the third pass that she deemed the halls sufficiently clear. While there were always at least a few guards on rotation, she knew from experience that there were lulls, especially during meals. It was supper hour, and most likely her best chance to avoid being noticed. The sorceress pressed her hand against the door's lock, speaking in a whisper.
Dominion of Knowledge, show me the structure within.
The structural analysis spell functioned differently from most of her other spells, presenting her with a series of images rather than text. She could see the interior of the lock, the positions of the tumblers, and the amount of open space inside the keyhole. Taking a breath, Lydia flexed the fingers on her right hand and formed an image of the necessary key in her mind.
Dominion of Protection, form a key to this door.
The shimmering construct in her hand wouldn't last long, but she took a moment to knock lightly on the door. There was no one in the hallways nearby to hear her, and now she needed to focus on making a first impression on the prisoner within. She wanted to be polite, but firm, and ultimately sympathetic if she decided to help him. She turned the sorceress key in the lock, hiding her uncertainty beneath a veneer of stoicism. Shortly thereafter, Lydia knelt over Istvan's fallen body, whispering a spell into his ear.
Dominion of Dreams, ravage his mind with nightmares of different versions of this confrontation.
She shuddered involuntarily in the aftermath of the spell. It was a horrible thing to do to a person, but better than slitting his throat.
Lady of Destiny, forgive me for abusing the gifts you gave me in your great kindness.
Using dream sorcery too frequently would wreak havoc on her ability to concentrate, but she had practiced frequently enough to be able to handle the use of two spells in a day without significant side effects. She had faked casting the knowledge spell that would supposedly erase Istvan's memories. She didn't have any spells with that exact function, and most people didn't have a high opinion of sorcery that caused nightmares. She didn't want Talion to formulate a poor opinion of her, especially now that it was looking more plausible that he really might be an agent of the gods. The nightmare spell wouldn't have any lasting negative effects on Istvan, but she hoped it would sufficiently disturb his memories of the event to prevent him from reporting her as a traitor. And even if he did report her, she could point out that he had been affected by dream sorcery, making his testimony unreliable. Talion and Lydia stripped Istvan of his robes and boots. While Talion put the boots on in place of his absurd makeshift greaves, Lydia switched out Istvan's robes for her own. His robes were slightly large, but she had no way of repairing the hole he had made in her robe with his incendiary spell. The damaged robes would have aroused suspicion on their way out, but oversized robes would not. Their formal uniform tunics were carefully tailored to fit each sorcerer, but the colorful robes they wore during daily business were much more varied in size and shape.
Why was Istvan here in the first place?
Lydia adjusted her newly acquired robes and belted her sword back into place.
He's not supposed to be due back for weeks. Moreover, if he is back, why wasn't I informed? Someone must have told him about the sword. Otherwise, he would have had no reason to be in the armory. There's nothing else being stored here that has value to a sorcerer. Is there?
Lydia quickly glanced around the room.
Dominion of knowledge, illuminate that which is touched by your cousins, she said, raising a hand to her forehead as she spoke.
A flash of green in the corner of her eye drew Lydia to look toward Talion, and she nearly blinded herself when her eyes settled upon the sheathed weapon he was holding.
Gods around us, she considered. Nothing should shine like that.
Her illumination spell was designed to be subtle, a quick indication of anything present with a detectable sorceress aura. The power of the sorcery should have been irrelevant. The spell was not designed to display that.
What could be causing that? Another defensive reaction? Several overlapping dominions, like I speculated about before?
Lydia turned her eyes away, ignoring the bright afterimage from the weapon's unexpected illumination. She saw no indication of any other objects in the room with a sorceress aura. She did a quick scan over Istvan's fallen body and found nothing on him either. This particular spell would not detect his ability to use sorcery, or anyone else's. It was only designed for finding objects. Similarly, it wouldn't pick up the nightmare spell's effect. She had other spells designed for tracking and identifying sorcerers and active spells.
We should get moving,
Lydia said, blinking to end the effects of her detection spell. She knew that supper would keep the palace staff relatively busy for the next hour or more, but she didn't need any additional complications. Ready when you are. Talion belted the sheathed Sakes around his waist and headed for the door. Lydia followed closely behind him and then took the lead after they stepped outside. The sorceress lifted a finger to her lips in the universal gesture for silence and then began to lead the way toward the palace's first floor. Once there, she knew they would begin to encounter more guards and palace workers.
Istvan could have been told about the prisoner by someone other than the other sorcerers,
Lydia considered as she walked.
If he hasn't seen any of them yet, perhaps he thought he could get to the weapon first and do something with it. That would explain why he was not aware of the plan, and why I wasn't warned. Or, alternatively, Morella could have told Istvan about the sword. She didn't seem to want to deal with the rest of us for some reason. Maybe she's hiding something. Intriguing possibilities, but all bothersome, she concluded.
Talion had fallen into position behind her and to the right, which Lydia noted to be an excellent position for him to protect her flank, given that most of the hallways that branched off from the main hall were on that side. It could have easily been a coincidence, but it was also plausible that he was familiar with the layout of the palace and taking his position for strategic purposes. For a time, their footsteps were the only noticeable sound, until they came near enough to the banquet hall to hear the sounds of supper. Several of the nobles who lived within the palace walls indulged in the late-night meal, but Lydia had never had the stomach for anything past dinner. She rarely even ate breakfast.
Talion is probably starving, she realized with a pang of guilt. There's no sense in risking a stop right now, but I'll need to find him something to eat later.
She could see a steady line of servants making their way to and from the banquet hall as they approached, as well as the two guards posted at the doors. She nodded to the guards as she approached, and they returned her gesture with a simple salute, bringing their right hands across their chest to their left shoulder. No further communication was required. The pair passed the banquet hall without further incident, turning left to make their way toward the entrance to the main hall. A patrolling pair of soldiers passed them, engrossed in conversation. Lydia ignored them, and they responded in kind. She found herself holding her breath as they made their way through the final hall toward the palace's entrance. Three of the door guards sat on the carpeted floor next to the closed door playing a dice game, while one other leaned over them, looking bored. Lydia mentally chastised them for their lack of discipline, but she knew that comings and goings at this hour were rare.
"Good evening,"
Lydia addressed them as she approached. The guards immediately straightened their posture, looking up at her. One of the sitting guards scrambled to his feet, but the others didn't make the effort.
"Evening, court sorceress," the guard who had stood up said. "How can we help ye?"
"Istvan and I are heading out for the evening. Can you unlock the door?"
she said, indicating the massive double doors with a gesture.
"Course, ma'am,"
the guard replied, moving over to the door.
Boys, help me out here.
The door was barred by an iron-framed wooden beam, designed to prevent it from being opened from the outside. Talion was eyeing the beam with a contemplative expression, which Lydia judged to be a sign that he was analyzing if he could manipulate the metal around from outside the door. The door itself was equally heavy and several inches thick. During the Zixian rule, the palace had been designed for a siege. Now most of the defenses had been long abandoned, but the heavy palace door had been maintained. The guards struggled for a few moments to lift the beam, setting it aside, and shoved against the heavy doors. Lydia felt the night air wash over her skin as the door opened.
"Thank you," she said, stepping past the guards and into the city.
Talion followed closely behind. Lydia took hasty steps across the cobblestone road out of the palace, even as the guards struggled to shut the doors behind the pair.
"Impressive," Talion said. "There were fewer complications than I expected."
The sorceress clenched her hands shut.
"We are not done yet. We still need to find you a safe place to stay."
"Any inn should suffice, wouldn't it?"
Talion replied. Lydia shook her head, still walking swiftly. They passed between twin lines of flowers that lined the palace road and beneath the stone archway that led into the nobles' district. Her original plan was to take him to the miners' district, one of the poorer parts of the city. As the night chill washed across her skin, that plan grew less appealing by the minute. She also reminded herself that while the poorer parts of the city would have fewer guards, their robes of office would also stand out much more.
"Nothing close by. Guards will start sweeping the city as soon as they discover your absence, and once Istvan has been found, your disguise will no longer be usable."
"Could we find a tailor, maybe?"
Talion inquired, his footsteps echoing just behind her. She couldn't tell from his tone if he was being sarcastic.
"Not at this late of an hour. Perhaps I should have carried an additional change of clothing for each of us, but carrying that much baggage would have stood out."
Lydia led the way silently for a time, considering other destinations. A brothel would still be taking customers at this hour and would more than likely be willing to sell them some other clothing. Unfortunately, she didn't know of any brothels nearby, and the parts of town more likely to have brothels would be less than safe at this hour. She didn't find it likely that anyone would try to rob a pair of court sorcerers, but she had heard stranger stories, and she didn't need any more trouble. As she considered where to find a high-quality inn on the edge of the nobles' district that would be discreet enough to serve their purposes, Lydia heard her footsteps fall into a gradual rhythm along with Talion's. That was when she noticed the additional rhythm of a third set of footsteps behind them, near perfectly matching their own. Lydia spun, drawing her hand across the air.
"Dominion of knowledge, illuminate the hidden!"
A flash of green light momentarily silhouetted a young man trailing a few feet behind them, unarmed and dressed in a simple tunic and pants. A look of shock crossed his features as he flailed his hands and stumbled backward, disappearing near instantly thereafter, but not before Talion had closed the distance between the two and grasped the man's shirt. Lydia drew her sword as Talion pulled the invisible man forward. As Lydia approached, she saw Talion's other arm reach upward and grab at the invisible figure at neck level.
"Stop! Wait!"
came a choking voice from the nothingness. Talion shoved forward, and Lydia heard the other figure collide hard against the cobblestones.
"A foolish move," Lydia considered. "Talion should have kept him pinned."
Even as Lydia chastised the former prisoner in her mind, however, Talion advanced on the invisible figure and knelt, opening his hands and bringing them down until they apparently connected with something.
"You should start talking," Talion said in his Istvan voice.
Lydia was momentarily startled, having forgotten that Talion was still supposed to be playing that role.
"I prefer my prisoners alive. My companion, on the other hand..."
"He wants me to play the antagonist? Fine, I can do that."
Lydia approached, leveling her sword near where Talion had made contact with the invisible figure. She couldn't make out where the invisible figure was lying. His spell must have been potent to keep him invisible even after he had been seen and assaulted. She could have revealed him again with another spell, but she decided to wait, Talion seemed to be physically overpowering the man without difficulty, and every spell had a cost.
We don't talk to assassins, Istvan. We eliminate them.
I'm not an assassin! Wait!
The man appeared abruptly, holding up his hands in a warding gesture. Talion's hands were encircling the smaller man's wrists. How Talion had managed to find the invisible man's arms was a mystery, but she reassessed her earlier idea that he had been reckless. Apparently, once he had detected their pursuer, Talion had some way of tracking the man.
Talk, Talion repeated, maintaining his ominous tone.
I know you're not Istvan,
the man said. Lydia raised her sword, causing the man's eyes to widen in horror.
No, no, stop! I'm here to help, please!
Help?
Lydia asked, examining the fallen man. He was olive-skinned, with short brown hair and a couple days of weak stubble. His glasses were thick enough to speak of some wealth, but his clothes were simple village fare, his tunic and pants a common brown in tone. There was a belt pouch on his right hip, but no sign of weapons.
I saw you escaping. I was going to help you. I know a place where you'll be safe,
the fallen man explained.
Please, I'm on your side.
My side? How do you even know what my... Oh, you're on Talion's side. That makes sense.
Do you know him? Lydia asked Talion, intentionally omitting his name.
No, Talion replied. To his credit, he maintained his Istvan voice.
While the newcomer appeared to know that the sorcerer was an imposter, any confirmation would have been unwise.
Who sent you?
Saved me that question, she considered.
The
man said nervously, struggling weakly against Talion's grip.
I should tell you my employer under more controlled circumstances.
Up,
Talion said, standing and wrenching the other man to his feet in the process.
I'm not sure this is wise,
Lydia offered, leveling her sword at the newcomer.
There are good odds he's leading us into a trap.
I know,
Talion said, letting go of the other man.
The sooner I walk into this particular trap, the sooner I can eliminate whoever set it.
Lydia narrowed her eyes.
That sounded insane. It could just be extreme confidence, but insanity is more probable.
It's not a trap,
the now visible newcomer said.
Just a place where other people won't overhear us so easily. The name is Jonin, by the way. Sorry to meet you under these circumstances.
Chapter 3. Definitely not a trap. Jonin rubbed at his sore wrists as he took the first steps into his borrowed home.
That man has hands like iron manacles,
the scholar considered.
Best to feed him a few relevant lies before they end up around my neck.
The house was large by Jonin's standards, but somehow he had managed to clutter the place almost immediately upon moving in. He stepped between a pair of tables near the entrance, attempting to put a bit of distance between himself and his would-be allies without looking too conspicuous about it.
Stay within reach,
the woman in the sorceress robes instructed him.
If you have assassins in one of the other rooms waiting for us, I want to have time to execute you before they're on us.
So much for that, Jonin considered with a grimace.
No assassins, I assure you.
But he slowed his steps regardless, gesturing broadly within the building.
Please, make yourselves comfortable. There's food in the cabinet over there,
he said, pointing to a cupboard near the opposite end of a distant room.
Feel free to help yourselves.
While I'm grateful for your hospitality, the brutally strong man said to him, I'd really rather know who you are.
Jonin sighed dramatically.
Have a seat, then.
He found his way to the kitchen table, which was covered with bits of metal, panes of glass, and tools. Afterward, he pulled a pair of chairs over for his guests.
Sorry, I wasn't expecting multiple guests. I would have made more room.
The other man seized one of the two seats that Jonin had offered, pulled it back a bit, and sat. The sorceress continued to stand, watching Jonin closely. Jonin nervously turned away from her gaze, finally sitting in the second chair himself, and turning to face the swordsman.
Tell us who you work for,
the woman demanded, leaning toward him just slightly. Jonin turned his head back toward her, playing through possible answers in his head, finishing the debate that had raged in his mind since they discovered him.
I am but a humble scholar, and when I happen to—
That's a bunch of resh. Start over,
the red-haired woman demanded, tapping the hilt of her sword meaningfully. Now that his first lie had been so easily dispelled, Jonan began the next.
No need for that sword, I assure you. I'm a friend. I believe I work for the same people that you do, but if you have the same instructions that I do, you would know that we have orders not to confirm that or interact with one another.
The sorceress's hand drifted away from her sword. Interesting, Jonan thought.
Interesting, the woman replied. And almost plausible. But given that we have already come into contact, it's too late for that sort of behavior. We should share what resources we have available, if you are, in fact, working for the same people that I am.
Would either of you tell me who you're talking about? The masked man asked them. He was still using an outrageously deep voice.
Jonan found it adorably pretentious.
No,
the sorceress replied.
Not really,
Jonan said, shaking his head. When Jonan had been given his assignment, he had been told that there was a single other person affiliated with his organization in the city. His instructions had been to communicate with his contact by trading information through anonymous notes, but he had explicit orders not to determine his contact's identity. For that reason, he had started looking for his contact's identity immediately, but thus far, he hadn't had any luck. When he had discovered that the bearer of the Seikes had been imprisoned, he had immediately reported that information to his contact. The sorceress's actions implied that she might be acting on the information he had provided. He considered asking her questions based on the notes he had sent to his contact, but he decided that might be playing his hand too quickly. Jonan turned back to the masked man.
Sorry, friend, but you haven't even told me your real name.
The masked man scoffed.
Any names we give one another are pointless until a level of trust is established.
Jonan put a hand over his chest, trying to look wounded by the point.
You don't trust me? I have guided you to the safety of my home, at great personal risk.
We seem to be at an impasse.
The woman leaned back against one of the tables behind her, pushing an unfinished mirror on top of it aside to make herself comfortable.
Fine. I'm not in the mood for riddles and games. I am Lydia, and I am a court sorcerer for Queen Regent Tylan. This man, she said, gesturing to Talion, is Valar, my apprentice.
Let me stop you there,
Jonan said, turning to sit sideways in his chair to address Lydia.
I already know that this man is a prisoner, and that you're helping him escape. I was planning to break him up myself, but you got to him first.
Lydia pushed her glasses up further on her nose.
That is quite an accusation you've made.
Again, there's no need for these pretenses. I will hide you until morning, at which point you can safely escape the city.
He gestured to the next room which contained the staircase, though it was currently obscured from his sight by a half-closed door.
I regret that I only purchased male clothing, as I did not anticipate your involvement.
Lydia glanced at her masked companion, and then back to Jonan.
How did you discover us?
I am a practitioner of sight sorcery, Jonan admitted. As I'm certain you noted from my attempt to follow you invisibly. I have been monitoring the comings and goings at the palace as best I could. When I saw the bearer of the sacred blade captured, I could not stand idly by and allow him to be harmed.
Jonan glanced back to the masked figure, but the other man just stared at him, his expression unreadable with the mask. It was somewhat disconcerting.
All right, Lydia said. Stand up. We're going to take a look around this place and make sure you don't have any friends listening in on us. When I'm satisfied we're alone, we'll talk further.
The ensuing tour of the house took a few tense minutes. He never could have afforded such a home on his own. The entrance chamber was cluttered with tables where he worked on various glasswork projects, such as mirrors, windows, and spectacles. The kitchen was directly across from the entrance, the majority of its brown wooden cabinets empty, but a few of them contained useful food or other more obscure supplies. On the right side of the main room, beyond a practical wall of junk, Jonan led them to the reading room. A single bookshelf held a dozen books on subjects ranging from local history to esoteric sorceress theory. They represented the bulk of his personal collection and the most valuable of all of his possessions. Beyond the reading room was his own bedroom, which he showed them hurriedly, explaining that he was embarrassed by the mess. Lydia maintained her usual dubious expression, but he didn't think she detected any of the irregularities that the room hid. Opposite the reading room was a stairway leading to the upper floor. The two upstairs doors led to the private room, which contained a bath and chamber pot, and the guest bedroom. The sorceress paused in each room to mutter a brief incantation, which Jonin assumed was a knowledge sorcery spell similar to the one she had used earlier. Afterward, Lydia still appeared nervous but satisfied that there was no one else to eavesdrop.
"Nothing on her garb to identify any affiliations outside from her current cover," Jonin considered. "She's cautious enough to be one of ours, though."
With the tour concluded, each of them returned to the front room, taking seats. In the absence of a third chair, Lydia sat on the table across from the two men, still looking like she might draw her blade and murder either or both of them at any moment.
"All right. If we're satisfied, I believe it's time for some honest discussion," Jonin offered, gesturing magnanimously with both hands.
The masked man glanced at Lydia one last time, to which she responded with a curt nod. With that, he pulled down his hood and removed his mask, revealing a surprisingly young man with dark hair and bright eyes. "You can call me Talion," the unmasked youth said in a new voice, still somewhat deep but much smoother in tone. "I came here to meet someone. My arrest was, so far as I can tell, a simple misunderstanding." Jonin laughed for just a moment before shaking his head to stop himself.
Sorry. A misunderstanding. Ah, my friend, you are far too kind to the people of this city."
"What do you mean?" Talion asked, furrowing his brow and leaning forward on his knees. Without the mask and the intimidating voice, he seemed a completely different person, almost childlike. "Is he just playing another character now?" Jonin wondered, but it was too soon to tell.
"Jonin is right," Lydia began before Jonin had a chance to explain. "Following the Taos Pantheon is illegal, but it's such a minor crime that it's almost never talked about. Typically, they're just given a small fine and sent on their way. You carried a sacred relic into the city. The court sorcerers believed this was an intentional act of aggression from Velthrin, a provocation meant to trigger an action on Orlan's part. I'm not sure I disagree."
Talion shook his head. "I had no idea about the law. I'm not a spy, nor would I be interested in starting any sort of conflict."
"No, but what about whoever sent you?"
Jonin asked. The dark-haired man reeled back as if he had been struck. "My parents? They would have no motive for that. I don't think they've ever even been here."
"That would explain their lack of knowledge of the law," Lydia said. "But your average civilian doesn't just carry around a weapon like that."
Talion nodded. "I apologize for inconveniencing you. I will be more careful about disguising the weapon in the future." Jonin quirked an eyebrow. "You're missing the point, friend. Even if your parents didn't have any idea about the law, it sounds as if someone set you up. Perhaps whoever you were sent to meet in the city."
"Eric Taran?" Talion mused aloud.
"The scholar," Jonin said incredulously. Lydia glanced at Jonin, offering him a wry grin.
"That's what I said, too."
"Ah, she can be amused. Progress." "Okay, so your parents told you to come to the city to meet a famous scholar, and I assume they gave you the most conspicuous object on the continent to bring along.
Did they happen to give a reason why?"
Jonin asked.
"To learn about my heritage," Talion explained, shaking his head. "My parents, well, they are not my real parents. They just took me in when I was a child, you see. They were given instructions to give me the sword when I came of age. I've been practicing with it for several years now, and my parents felt I was ready to come to try to discover where I came from."
"You can use the sword?"
Lydia recoiled, eyes widening slightly. "Only in the loosest sense of the word use," Talion replied, sounding oddly embarrassed.
"Wait. Who gave your parents these instructions?"
Jonin asked.
"Eric Taran did. He's the one who left me and the sword with them. He said that I should come find him when I'm old enough."
"This is quickly turning into an interrogation," Lydia pointed out. "Talion, you don't have to be so quick to volunteer information. In fact, I'd advise against it."
Jonin gave Lydia a pouty expression for spoiling his fun.
"It's fine," Talion said.
I have nothing to hide. I'm sure you two are both thinking about using me and this information to your political advantage. I don't really care. Telling you what I know is probably the fastest way to reach my own goals.
That makes things much easier, then.
Jonan flipped his dour expression into a grin.
So, does your family have any enemies?
Talion shook his head. None that I'm aware of, and certainly none in this city. I suspect you're overthinking this. My parents, not knowing the law, send me to find information. I, not knowing the law, blunder my way into an arrest. The sorcerers see a conspiracy, but I see little more than a coincidence.
Perhaps, Jonan replied dubiously. There is only one way to find out with any certainty, however.
Find Eric Taran?
Lydia mused, folding her arms.
That's doubtful at best. The man stopped publishing books more than 15 years ago. In all likelihood, that's because he's dead. He was over 100 years old. Even a powerful sorcerer can only extend his life for so long.
You're awfully quick to discard our only source of information. Jonan wagged a finger at Lydia for emphasis.
First, we haven't even established that we're actually on the same side. And second, searching for a presumably dead man while hiding a fugitive who is carrying one of the most valuable relics in the world is somewhat absurd, don't you think?
Lydia countered, staring back at Jonan.
Sounds like fun to me, Jonan said, looking over at Talion. What do you think?
Please be as impressionable and foolish as you look.
That does sound pretty exciting, Talion said, nodding lightly.
Thank you.
Lydia shook her head fervently.
Look, I can't just go running around the city with a fugitive. He needs to be out of the city, and then I can pursue this Eric Taran business, if there's anything to be pursued, without having to worry about having Talion recaptured. Talion, I'd be glad to bring Eric Taran to meet you somewhere outside the city if I can find him,
she offered, a pleading expression on her face.
Assuming, of course, that you work for someone we can trust. You've already clearly betrayed the government of Orlin. Who's to say you wouldn't just kill this Eric Taran if you find him? Or turn him into your own people to steal his secrets?
Jonan leaned forward in his chair, narrowing his eyes. He was making a rough gamble, and he knew it. He had to hope that Talion's lack of trust for Lydia was sufficient to put Talion on his side. Talion, unfortunately, remained silent. He scratched at his chin, looking to Lydia, apparently seeking her guidance.
Resh! All right, Lydia said. You tell me who you work for and why you're here, and I'll tell you who I work for and why I'm here,
she offered Jonan.
Do we have a deal?
Jonan nodded without hesitating.
This should be interesting, if nothing else. You first, then,
Lydia said.
Oh, come on. I didn't expect that.
Very well, Jonan said. I am a humble servant of the priesthood of His Majesty Valian, the King of Thorns.
Lydia's eyes narrowed.
That can't be good.
Jonan tried to subtly reach for one of the pouches at his side, but it was too far away at his current angle.
You're a Kessite?
Lydia asked, tilting her head to the side. Jonan nodded.
Yes, of sorts.
Bad luck for you, I'm afraid.
She gave him an apologetic look, standing up.
I'm Lydia Hastings of the Paladins of Cytira, and you are my prisoner.
All things considered, Lydia was a fairly courteous captor. She had bound Jonan's wrists with some of his own hemp rope, which he had graciously provided to her, and ordered Talion to keep an eye on him.
A god's cursed paladin? Really? I couldn't have been fairly expected to guess that.
Lydia apparently worshipped Cytira, one of the 7 gods of the Taos Pantheon. Cytira was particularly associated with the acquisition and distribution of information, which made Lydia's usage of knowledge sorcery unsurprising within that context. More surprising was that she was a paladin, essentially a warrior dedicated to enforcing the tenets of her religion. Paladins of Cytira were usually assigned to finding and stopping abuses of sorcery. He had never heard of one being utilized as a long-term spy. Jonan, on the other hand, was a follower of Valian, a solitary deity with many demigods, known as the Vacus, in his service. The two religions were often at odds, and many legends depicted the leaders of the Taos pantheon as Valian's personal rival. At present, the followers of the two religions were not engaged in any open hostilities with one another, but they tended to keep their distance. For Lydia, Jonan knew that the sword would be a symbol of the strength and love of her gods. For Jonan, it was a bargaining chip, the weapon of Valian's legendary opponent.
Deciding to steal a Taos artifact is probably a bit above my level of authority,
Jonan considered.
But it's awfully tempting. Using the wielder of the Sekhes as a tool, however, fits perfectly within my mission parameters. It even clearly deflects blame away from Valian. The Taos Pantheon would look responsible.
You can still help yourselves to the food, Jonan offered weakly.
It's probably poisoned,
Lydia replied dryly. She hadn't drawn her sword, thankfully, but now she was watching him with twice the intensity she had been before. This was impressive, seeing as she had already looked like she could burrow straight through a wall with her eyes.
It's not poisoned. It's food. I eat it.
Here, bring me some bread. I'll take the first bite, Jonan offered.
You're probably immune to your own poison.
Lydia shifted in her seat.
That's absurd.
Look, I admitted I work for the priesthood of Valian. I'm not a priest myself, and even if I was, that wouldn't make me some sort of assassin, he offered.
No, working for the priesthood and not being a priest is what makes you an assassin. Or, at very least, a spy,
Lydia replied.
She's not entirely wrong,
Jonan admitted silently. They did have other branches to the organization, but he was a field agent, not a civilian or even a member of their own pseudo-military. He had never killed anyone, but he was certainly a spy.
Right, yes, I'm clearly a spy, Jonan said in a deadpan tone.
Lydia tilted her head to the side inquisitively.
No more or less than you are, if you'll forgive me for saying so, and I doubt you poison the contents of your cupboard just for the contingency that you might be having guests that you need to murder.
Lydia nodded slowly.
You're right. That would be a needlessly extreme measure, as well as careless. Talion, you can bring us some of his food.
The dark-haired youth turned his head to her. I appreciate your permission, but it's not necessary.
I don't work for you,
he noted in a bemused tone. He paused for a moment, and then stood and added,
But I am very hungry.
Ah, the lad has some autonomy after all.
That's good. That could work to my advantage later.
Lydia sighed as Talion started walking to the kitchen.
Sorry to presume, Talion. Please bring us all some food to eat. It's been a long day for both of us.
Jonan watched Talion go to the cupboard, nodding silently in response to Lydia.
Good move, paladin. Remind him you're human and smooth things over. Keep your game piece friendly.
Look, we don't need to be at odds about any of this. While I recognize that our religions don't always get along,
and occasionally engage in holy wars against one another,
Lydia added, folding her arms and smirking.
We can still find common ground on these issues. Neither of us wants the Sekhes in the hands of the local gods. Neither of us wants anything of importance in the hands of the local gods.
Jonan gestured to the ceiling with his bound wrists.
True,
Lydia confessed.
But I find the idea of the Sekhes in Valian's hands, or worse, his son's, to be far more disturbing than losing it here.
Jonan deliberately kept his expression as neutral as he could, but the mention of Valian's son sent a torrent of painful memories through his mind.
A teenaged girl with a manic grin, the blood on her right hand illuminated by a globe of flame hovering above it, oppressing heat everywhere, smoke thick enough to crush his lungs, the screams of the dying reverberating around him while he hid, useless, praying that he would not be seen.
No, he considered grimly. His son is not the one you need to worry about.
Well, while I am quite certain that I would be rewarded, immensely, in fact, for securing that weapon, you've made it more than evident that I will not succeed in doing so. Moreover, our good friend Talion,
he gestured to Talion, who was returning carrying a plate with a loaf of bread and a carving knife,
would likely be averse to either of us taking charge of the sword he carries.
The sword stays with me,
Talion said simply, setting down the bread plate on the nearby table with a loud clack.
Right, Jonan said with a faint hint of laughter in his voice. So, since that is settled, we can feel free to cooperate on other matters.
Lydia glanced at the bread that was now seated next to her, and then back to Jonan. Talion began to cut the bread into smaller slices.
I see little else we could cooperate on. I appreciate you providing a place for us to stay for the evening. We will keep watches to ensure you do not try to kill us or take the sword while we rest. In the morning, if you have not betrayed us, I can escort Talion out of the city.
Lydia shifted her gaze between the two men, scrutinizing.
I'd like to hear his proposal, actually, Talion said.
Lydia frowned, turning to glance at Talion.
You don't know these Kessites. They can't be trusted.
Think back to the beginning of our conversation with him. He tried to mislead us twice before admitting who he worked for.
What? You mean sort of like you dressing up like a court sorceress and helping a prisoner escape?
Jonan shot back.
I am a court sorceress, Lydia growled. I was hired legitimately.
Jonan nodded, putting on an impressed face.
So you actually infiltrated the government of a nation rather than just putting on a costume. Well, that's certainly a step up in scale.
Lydia glowered at him.
Yes, I am capable of deception as well. Talion doesn't have to trust me either. The distinction is that I've already helped him escape a prison, so he knows that unless that was some sort of absurdly long-term plan, I am legitimately trying to help him. You, on the other hand, just happen to be tracking us on the way out.
A good point, and one I don't have a very strong counter to. Still, I've planted a few sprouts of doubt in Talion's head, at least.
Peace, Jonan said. I concede that. You are clearly trying to help him.
That wasn't really true. It was plausible this really was a longer-term plan on her part, but he didn't need to antagonize the paladin any more.
Let me help you both. Not out of goodness, as you would never believe such a motive, but out of self-interest. I didn't come to this city for the sword, just as you didn't. We are both working against Orlin in different ways. Allow me to assist you.
Lydia swept up a piece of bread with her left hand, bit into it, and put her hand back down without ever looking away from Jonan. He blinked in response.
All right, Lydia said. Let's hear why you're in the city and what you have to offer.
Excellent, Jonan replied, grinning slightly. When her eyes narrowed in response, he knew he had just made his pleasure a tad too overt, but he continued regardless.
One of Orlin's gods is called Adon. He appears to be human, but he has presided over the city for 14 years with no signs of growing older. Much as you pointed out when we discussed Eric Torren, slowing the aging process is difficult, and every sorcerer that I have studied has eventually run into limitations. Baron Edric Theus is perhaps the oldest human alive, but even he appears to be ancient and withered. He will eventually die. This Adon apparently looks younger than when he first appeared, which could be an illusion, or it could be that he's found some way to reverse the aging process.
Certainly, I've met the man myself, Lydia said. He only looks to be about 30 or 35. The people of Orlin say he is a god. Do you have a reason to believe otherwise?
Oh, yes, Jonan said, grinning and folding the fingers of his bound hands together. I have discovered who he once was.
Lydia adjusted her glasses again, her gaze shifting to the side for the first time. Nervousness, perhaps? Jonan couldn't quite tell.
What have you found?
Lydia asked, her tone sounding more suspicious rather than curious. She looked back to Jonan, pressing her lips together.
Perhaps I stumbled upon a line of conversation I should have avoided, but it's too late now.
We believe Adon was once Redeemer Donovan Taylor, Jonan said. A former priest of Cytira of some repute, Lydia added, speaking to Talion, and then turning back toward Jonan. Go on.
We believe he is preserving his life by stealing the lives of others.
Lydia folded her arms across her chest. While she was trying to look taciturn, Jonan thought he caught a flicker of something. Concern, perhaps, in her eyes.
And what led you to that conclusion?
Careful now. Too late to back out, but if she discovers too much, I might end up eating a yard of steel instead of that delicious bread.
Jonan took a deep breath, considering where to begin. About